podcast component of ArmageddonLetters.com, a virtual time machine back to the moment the world was nearly destroyed in late October of 1962. You can also follow us on Twitter at ArmageddonTweet. I'm Jim Blight.
And I'm Janet Lang. We think it's important to really understand Cuba. A lot of people talk about the Cuban Missile Crisis almost exclusively in terms of the U.S. and the Soviet Union, the big powers.
Eyeball to eyeball.
Right.
The other guy blinked.
But we think it's really important to take a look at the theater of operations, in a sense, to get into the Cuban Missile Crisis. And for that, you really have to start understanding Cuba, what the Cuban leadership believed and understood, what they tried to convey to the people, what the people absorbed and agreed with. And so we want to take you back, actually, to February 4th, 1962, 10 months after the Bay of Pigs invasion, where the U.S. tried, with supporting some Cuban exiles, to overthrow Fidel and was defeated, but also still months before the Cuban Missile Crisis is going to happen. This is where we are now, February 1962. For the superpowers at this point, the U.S. and the Soviet Union, Cuba is off their scope. They're not thinking about it now. They thought about it a little bit with the Bay of Pigs, and they'll think about it a whole lot more with the missile crisis. But in between, neither one of them could almost care less about that. They have other big issues that they're discussing. There's problems in Laos, there's problems in Berlin, there's problems in Vietnam, and there's big problems about atomic testing.
Parenthetically, one of the reasons that Cuba goes off the scope of the superpowers is that there are some things going on elsewhere that are really dangerous. People are recommending to Kennedy over Laos, if you can believe it, in the spring of 1961, that he ought to consider using tactical nuclear weapons to kick the Pathet Lao, the communist insurgency, out of Laos. And then Berlin, that was the scariest of all up to this point. The wall started going up in 1961 on August 13th, the wall that many of you listening have never seen because it was already down by the time you were born, and that had several moments that seemed really spooky and scary. So here we are, we're kind of in the midpoint here of the sleepwalk, as we like to call it, the sleepwalk by the superpowers, kind of like, oh, those Cubans, there they go again, they're talking. Talking, talking.
And Fidel is constantly talking, by the way. It's not like he's quiet during this time. He's giving tons of speeches to thousands of people and so forth.
They know that the Kennedy administration is about to pass through Congress what is now known as the embargo, the embargo, sanctions against Cuba.
No. That will actually go into effect a few days after this.
Yes, but it's being discussed all over the political spectrum in the U.S., and the Cubans are preparing for it. But then there's an event that speeds this along, and on January 31st, down in Punta del Este, Uruguay, Douglas Dillon, who is Kennedy's Secretary of the Treasury, leads a delegation down there that includes Richard Goodwin, one of Kennedy's speechwriters in White House. He's actually an assistant at this point to Ted Sorensen, who is the chief speechwriter for Kennedy. They go to Punta del Este, and the primary outcome of that is that Cuba is kicked out, expelled from the Organization of American States, the OAS. It took a while to get the countries on board. There were some abstentions, Mexico notably. In Cuba, Mexico is always known as the honorable exception because they have never voted against Cuba in an OAS vote.
The ostensible reason for expelling Cuba is that their socialist and communist proclivities were, quote, incompatible with the inter-American system.
Yes, that's...
They basically were an island of socialism and communism at that point, and totally incompatible, actually, with the not so much inter-American system, but the American system.
Yeah, well, most of the American system was ruled by military dictators at this point. You know, the ilk of Juan Perón, people like that, who were not exactly Democrats, but they tended to be pro-U.S. rather than pro-communist. So Cuba is booted out, And the Second Declaration of Havana appears, and it is considered to be one of the great documents of the decolonization period of the late 50s and early 1960s. Remember, Cuba was not officially a colony of anybody after 1895 when the Spaniards were thrown out. If you're a Cuban, you're feeling oppressed. U.S. has invaded the island five times in the first 50 years of the 20th century just to put things in order. Now, the Second Declaration of Havana is a favorite of ours because it's so over the top. For example, Fidel Castro says the following: "What this nightmare in Latin America adds up to is that this continent of almost 200 million human beings, two-thirds of whom are Indians, mestizos, or Negroes, the discriminated races in this continent, the death rate of their death rate from hunger, curable disease," he goes on and on like this. And he comes up with a number at 4 persons per minute, 5,500 per day, 2 million per year, 10, remember, this is sort of Fidel at his finest, 10 million every 5 years. Meanwhile, an unending torrent of money flows from Latin America to the United States that is stolen. Not only enslave these people, you steal all their money at, what's the rate now? 4,000 per minute, 5 million per day, 2 billion per year, 10 billion every 5 years, blah, blah, blah. And that comes to $1,000 per corpse by premature death caused by American imperialism, or 4 per minute.
One of our friends,
Maurice Halperin, a great historian of Cuba,
had just a great phrase to describe that paragraph. Basically, he says, the arithmetic was dubious, but the invective was superb. So Fidel goes on and on in this.
Well, it should say here that this is, as Janet said, it's not a speech, but it is printed, well, that's in the day when you had to print things, in the hundreds of thousands, and it is distributed all over the world, and it becomes one of the fundamental documents of what was then called the Third World. This is how you throw off the slave mentality.
And the main sort of tagline from this speech that becomes iconic in Cuba, it becomes iconic across the globe in so-called Third World countries at that point, is Fidel saying, writing, quote, "The duty of every revolutionary is to make the revolution." And it's what a large, large majority of people in Cuba believe.
Yes.
Certainly there were dissidents, a lot of them in jail or sort of self-censoring themselves. But an awful lot of the population at this point is caught up in this revolutionary fervor and feeling it.
This is a statement of pride. This is Cuba power. This is a statement that we have arrived. We are no longer going to trash your baskets and take your garbage out. We are important. Cuba matters, and you have to listen to us.
But it also, importantly, like every speech that Fidel has given from pretty much everyone, from the time of the Bay of Pigs up through the missile crisis, it also includes a very interesting reference to the U.S. So he says in it, quote, "Even if the Yankee imperialists prepare a bloody drama for America, they will not succeed in crushing the people's struggles. They will only arouse universal hatred against themselves, and such a drama will also mark the death of their greedy and carnivorous system." He's basically saying, if you try to come after us, it will be your doomsday.
One of Khrushchev's favorite things to say about Fidel was that he's shooting off his mouth again. He told his son Sergei this over and over again, that you have to sort of take, when you buy into Castro, you got to accept a lot of that verbiage, and a lot of it isn't going to be very complimentary toward you.
It's very difficult, I think, for citizens in North America, citizens in Europe, to understand this sense of pride that was evoked by Fidel in the 60s, because for many years before, people weren't so proud of being Cuban. But now they are, at least a large, large majority of them. The other sort of adjectives that you'd use to describe this second declaration would be defiance and resistance.
That's right.
And it's that angle, that the superpowers miss, really.
Yeah. The superpowers have superpower of one kind, but small countries have another kind of power, and Fidel Castro was one of the best articulators of it. They have commitment. They may be willing to go down with the ship. They may be willing to essentially die and know that they're going to die. They may have that kind of commitment.
They will outlast you. This second declaration is what we might call bad news for both superpowers. Right,
that's Jim? Right. El deber de todo revolucionario es hacer la revolución. The duty of every revolutionary is to make the revolution. This is bad news for Kennedy and the Americans. Why? Because he is telling you, I'm going to overthrow all of these puppet governments that you support all over Latin America, number one. Number two, hey, Khrushchev, guess what? You better pay attention to this because we intend to make the revolution. We do. We encourage other people to make their own revolutions, and that does not include taking orders from you just because we accept your weapons or your advice. So Fidel becomes a tremendous hero all over the Third World for statements exactly like this, although there are few that really match the kind of over-the-top anti-imperial eloquence that the Second Declaration does. But as Janet said, he says that if the U.S. tries something, it will mark the death of their greedy and carnivorous system. I mean, this guy is going all the way. You mess with us, you die, even if you're the most powerful country in the history of the world. I don't know how many people would have read this at the time and would have understood that he was absolutely serious. He's not speaking metaphorically of the death of America. He's talking about its destruction. And that will become obvious only in October with the Cuban Missile Crisis.
So resistance.
Yes.
Resistance of the U.S. and, as Jim said, resistance of the Soviets. This is the state of mind in Cuba in the months before the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yes, utterly unappreciated by either superpower. Well, that's it for this podcast. Visit us regularly for more in the podcast series, as well as news about our new book, the short films, the graphic novels, and by special arrangement, blogs by our three leaders. And don't forget to visit us at facebook.com/Armageddon Letters. I'm Jim Blight.
And I'm Janet Lang. Thanks for joining our time machine. Thanks for taking a trip with us to Cuba land. Take care.